Well, good morning. We're ready to start our class. Today is December 10th, and this is our third installment of Matthew Henry's discourse on meekness and quietness of spirit. We're going to pick up in chapter 1, where we left off last week, or last month. We were in the middle of chapter 1, and Henry offered, by way of reminder, Henry offered a definition of meekness as there is a meekness toward God, and it is the easy and quiet submission of the soul to his whole will, according as he is pleased to make it known, whether by his word or by his providence. So this meekness is an easy and quiet submission of the soul to his whole will, according as he is pleased to make it known, whether by his word or by his providence. And so the idea that God would direct us to submit to what he has written in his word, I think, is easy for people to understand and follow. And we looked at some of the complexity, though, when we're asked to submit to God's revealed will as it relates, or as it is revealed through his acts of providence. That seems to be the much harder way to understand God's will, and it's harder for us to swallow. So we looked at what the confession had to say on chapter 5, sections 1 and 2, and how God orchestrates and governs the world. So Henry, in this section, and we're in 1A2, if you saw the outline and are interested, but Henry has in mind that this submitting to God, this meekness toward God revealing his way through acts of providence, is being the hard sell for our life. So when we encounter God's word and it says something, it's probably a little easier for us to see the authority of it. We might still bristle at the implications of what God has set forth in his word, but I think we're all probably just smart enough to know not to argue with the authority of God's word. However, when it comes to these acts of providence, it becomes a little more difficult, because it's usually being expressed through, say, nature. We looked at a few events that could come at us through nature. But most of the time, it seems like it's expressed through people. And they can make our life very difficult. So Henry writes that when the events of providence are grievous and afflictive, displeasing, let me pull this up here. That's the definition. I should have had that up there a moment ago. When the events of providence are grievous and afflictive, displeasing to sense and crossing our secular interests, meekness not only quiets us under them, but reconciles us to them, and enables us not only to bear, but to receive evil as well as good at the hand of the Lord. So he has in mind these events that are grievous and afflictive, it's a wording he uses, displeasing to sense and crossing our secular interest. That covers a wide range of activity. And meekness quiets us under these acts of providence. And it extends even further. It's not just that meekness makes us quiet underneath, which is what it should do, but it reconciles us to them. It sees the authorship of God's hand in the middle of the circumstances that we find ourselves, and enables us not only to bear, but to receive evil as well as good at the hand of the Lord. So that's a tall order, to think that God, in his acts of providence toward us, would command us to be meek in submitting to him, and do so in a way that would bear and receive and be reconciled to the evil as well as to the good that God doles out. So one of the examples he uses is Job in chapter 2, verse 10, but Job, and as he said to her, "You speak as one of the foolish women speaks. Shall we indeed accept good from God, and shall we not accept adversity?" And all this, Job did not sin with his lips. So at least Job is quiet during this time. What's Job's inner disposition? Well, we don't see that. Obviously, he's bothered as we see the book unfolding and Job looking for answers, that he's not fully reconciled to his circumstances yet. But he is meek in his submission to God's providential dealing with him and correcting his wife. But there's another example here in Leviticus 10 that I think is worth looking at. Then Nadab and Abihu, the sons of Aaron, each took his censer and put fire in it, put incense on it, and offered profane fire before the Lord, which he had not commanded them. So fire went out from the Lord and devoured them, and they died before the Lord. And Moses said to Aaron, "This is what the Lord spoke, saying, by those who come near me, I must be regarded as holy, and before all the people, I must be glorified." So Aaron held his peace. When I encounter that passage, more often than not, especially in Reformed Presbyterian circles, I tend to hear people describe how God likes worship ordered. It's true, right? We see an example here that's often taken, that we ought only to do those things that God has commanded us to do. But isn't that really using Nadab and Abihu as object lessons? When at one level, the actual circumstances, the on-the-ground experience was, a man just saw his two sons were slaughtered right before him, summarily executed. And perhaps it's well worth our time to spend some effort thinking about the end of this verse. So Aaron held his peace. So imagine the circumstances where you're inaugurating something that should bring great joy to all around, and God decides to kill two of your kids. Slaughters them right there in front of you. And they're dead. There they are. What's your response? Aaron held his peace. It's really quite remarkable if you think about this passage in terms of meekness, and it's, I don't think looking at it this way diminishes the importance of looking at the holiness of God and how he demands to be treated, especially in worship. But it is asking an awful lot, and it is acting in a profound way to hold your peace when something like that happens. It shows what it means to submit in terms of adversity. In a sense, this is what the passage in Job 2 is telling us as well, isn't it? That's Job lost his family. He lost everything. And what does he do? He quiets himself and corrects his wife and says, this is the position we find ourselves in. We have to receive evil as well as good. But it's an easy thing to skip over, in a sense, isn't it? We look at the circumstances in our life, and I don't know of anybody who's endured this kind of trial and kept his mouth shut. I can't hardly think of anybody who had endured the trial period, whether they talked a lot or not. But meekness is this quiet submission to God's will and saying, I will hold my peace. I'll receive evil from the Lord as well as good. That's a cold blast of air to start a book on meekness, isn't it? To use as an example something like this. The will of God being revealed to us primarily through people and acts of providence is something where I think we relate at a much less significant level, an insignificant level. People have discussed road rage. You know, folks in front of us cut us off in traffic, or things were difficult, or my employer or my boss was this way, or my coworkers, or my neighbor was cross with me, or the difficulties that we experience in the normal course of our life are hard enough to submit to. But Henry takes us to a high point here and says, no, this is what meekness looks like. The stakes are quite high. And yet, they're not high enough. When we look at these two instances, we find that Henry doesn't let it sit there. He provokes us yet just a little more and says, no, there's more to this meekness than what meets the eye. When we are faced with something difficult in terms of God's revealed will as it's expressed through His providence. And I keep repeating those ideas because I think they're harder ones for us to learn. Henry writes that when God's anger is kindled, ours must be stifled. Such is the law of meekness, that whatsoever pleases God must not displease us. When God's anger is kindled, ours must be stifled. Such is the law of meekness, that whatsoever pleases God must not displease us. So, if it pleased God to kill two of your kids, will that displease you? Where are your affections aligned? That's really hard, isn't it? To think about the way in which God providentially rules over all things. Say He brings disease. He brings pestilence of some kind. A tornado, the whirlwind, whatever. And He brings it to people close to us. Henry's point in driving home our reconciliation to the revealed will of God is, I think, pretty tough. That these things obviously please God, right? It pleased God to kill Nadab and Abihu. How do we know that it pleased God to do that? How do we determine whether some act of providence pleased God? What would be some of the tools we use to determine that? Who's got a suggestion? God does all that He pleases. Yeah,
it happened,
right? Yeah. So if it happens, it must have pleased God on some level, right?
In this case, also there was a word from the Lord that we have very often used.
In the second case or the first one?
In the second case.
Yeah. That's right. Well, it's reinforced by that word, isn't it? But it was demonstrated in providence. So, when we think of God doing things, do we think in terms of what God does is pleasing to Him? Is that the way we think about His rule for the world around us? Probably not. Not all the time. And I suspect it's because our affections are not as aligned with His as we'd like for them to be. But that's the hard reconciliation. That's the hard thing to have to face. Who are we to argue with the perfection of God's designs? Right? And when you think back in Henry's day, as we went through his biography, just how many people died in Henry's life through disease? Disease that today is preventable completely. And how much misery that he had in his life in terms of his own health, which is probably largely preventable today as well. And then it took him a few days to die after his riding accident on the horse. He didn't die instantly. It took him a little while. So that's a hard life. I suspect his life was probably not much harder than anybody else's around. No reason to think he was singled out and peculiar for difficulty. But the world in which he lived and where he could write these worlds was a world filled with a lot of suffering and death, and said, this is what pleased God. It pleased God to kill my wife when my firstborn came into the world, which is what happened with Henry. So that's a remarkable insight to be able to look at these acts of providence and say, what does God's word have to say about this? We must also learn submission when the providence surrounding our lives is dark and intricate. So there's a difference, I think, when God strikes your sons dead in an act of worship. At least you can see, as was mentioned, that there was clear teaching that needed to be followed, and say, well, at least they knew the rules and for whatever reason didn't follow it, it didn't work out, whatever was going on, in which I think it's fair to say nobody really knows what was happening during that time. But God at least gave a warning. But what do you do when the providence surrounding our lives is very dark and intricate? Henry notes that when the methods of providence are dark and intricate, and we are quite at a loss what God is about to do with us, a meek and quiet spirit acquiesces in an assurance that all things shall work together for good to us, if we love God, though we cannot apprehend how or which way. So meekness has an additional element of trust built into it, that though we can't see the way forward, we do know who is leading the way forward. And we can trust that that person is being good to us. So there are times, there are probably more times than not, that we will not have an explanation as to why something is happening, right? You generally... the phrase is often used, this side of glory. I'm not sure how clearly we're going to see historical events on that side of glory. We might see them and still not understand them. But right now, it's difficult to see clearly why God is doing what He's doing. It's difficult to understand what end it may serve or what the cost might ultimately or eventually be, right? We don't know what the costs are going to be downstream. And we also don't know when it will end, right? There's plenty about our lives that we just don't know. And it's at these times, at points in our life where we are very weak because of the lack of understanding and the lack of insight, that your best bet is to double down on meekness. The best bet when things are dark and intricate, when the path is not clear, is to double down in meekness. And I think Romans 8 comes to mind. People often start in verse 28 as they think about reconciling acts of providence, and it began to think that maybe starting in verse 26 could also be helpful. Likewise, the Spirit also what? He helps when? In our weaknesses. Well, what other time are you expressing weakness when things are dark and intricate? And if you don't know what's happening, you don't know why it's happening, you don't know what end it serves, you don't know what the cost eventually going to be, and you don't know when the end of the matter will arrive. That's a pretty weak position. If you were bargaining, you would not be in a position of strength. You'd be the one who was wholly dependent on someone else. But it's in that time where the Spirit helps in our weaknesses, for we do not know what we should pray for as we ought, but the Spirit Himself makes intercession for us with groanings which cannot be uttered. Now He who searches the hearts knows what the mind of the Spirit is, because He makes intercession for the saints according to the will of God. So when we get to Romans 28 and we realize how things work together, it's helpful, I think, to remember the verses prior to that, that the Spirit is also lending aid, coming alongside of us, helping us in our times of intercession when we are unable to do so. Knowing that, we can then recall that we know that all things work together for those who love God, to those who are called according to His purpose. So it continues in verse 29 and 30, but I'm going to skip those for the time being. So the answer, meekness offers an answer for us that says, you don't know the answers to what's happening. And you don't need to know the answers. This insatiable curiosity that tends to plague all of us, why is this happening to me, reveals how foolish a question it is to begin with. You don't know. And if God hasn't revealed it, you asking it more and more, and driving your mental energy toward an end that cannot be satisfied, is only going to bring hopelessness. You don't know why, and God hasn't told you. But you do know who is behind it. And you do know what end He has in mind, that He will eventually redeem His saints and glorify a people, including you, for Himself. And why he does things the way he does is his wisdom. It's not ours. We have no right to inquire into that if he hasn't revealed it. Now, it is true that sometimes, over the long haul, we might be able to look back over a situation and see the wisdom of what happened or why things worked out the way they did, and that's fine. But when you're dealing with people and interpersonal relationships, you may not understand why things worked out the way they did. You may discover that there was something in your life that needed to be addressed that you didn't see ahead of time. But you don't know what's being addressed in another person's life. You don't know what's being addressed in people outside of that. You may have a conflict with this person, but that conflict might have other people associated with it that you can't see. And Aslan would say, well, that's not your story. And it's not your story in the sense that you're not going to know now, and you may not know later. But that doesn't mean God doesn't have a reason why he's doing what he's doing. And meekness is not afraid to double down on quietness and submission to what God is doing in our life, even when the matter is dark and intricate. Have any comments or questions before we move to the next section? Yes.
This covers one side of the equation. The other side, the example that you had of Nadab and Abihu is a perfect example of what you're saying. But the meekness reacts with trust and understands, as you know, Aaron held his peace. In life, that's not the way that situations present themselves. The other situations have the ability to actually ask the question and to be okay in asking that question. Not necessarily why, God, but what can I do about it? Do I need to sit in this situation and be overwhelmed by it, or do I have a responsibility to engage and to actually change that? So your point is about meekness, but it gets muddy, it gets messy when you get into life and actually go, how do I discern this crossing of the line between meekness and actually having the responsibility to change the circumstances in whatever?
Yeah, I'm not sure I would think there is a line that has to be drawn. The Psalms are filled with people that ask questions, how long? How long, O Lord, are you going to let this happen? Have you seen this, God? Do you realize what's going on? Which obviously has a poetic element to it. Nobody would accuse God of being blindsided, but David reminds God frequently of what's happening here. And I think the idea of trying to extract yourself from something that's difficult is fine. It's the insistence on understanding why before you'll accept it that I think is the point, one of the points Henry is driving home. When the matter is dark and intricate, there may be an easy exit strategy in part, but that doesn't explain why it happened in the first place. And so when a person, and I think we've all seen people who sort of latch on to, well, I don't know why this is happening to me, and I can't figure out what God's trying to do. Okay, well, so you don't know. I don't know either, and I don't know anybody else that does. But that's the situation you're finding yourself in, so what do you do at that point? Well, meekness doubles down on a difficult situation and says, I need to submit it this case. The reality of the situation is that I have to submit inwardly to be at peace with what God's doing. What happens as I work through that situation is rather open-ended. You know, I can move. David would flee or something along those lines, or try to be reconciled with the person at hand, or whatever the particular circumstances require. I think what Henry is getting at is the cloudiness that surrounds the meekness or the acts of providence in our life and the insistence on knowing why.
But to acquiesce to the situation and just say, I'm reacting in a meek and quiet spirit doesn't necessarily, that may not be the long-term.
Oh, that's correct. You may need to do many different things. But meekness does acquiesce and says, this is the hand of God. And the reality that I'm experiencing is God has brought some difficulty in my life, and I need to reconcile myself to that. Rather than, but it doesn't require that a person do nothing about it. But the submission first comes with recognizing that this is a hard, difficult, or intricate act of providence. Does that make sense? Yeah.
I'm just reminded again, the parallel here with Rear Wheel Christian Contentment by Jeremiah Burroughs, which again I would refer the listeners to Dave's class on that. 15 years ago, I believe it was, on our website, where he talks about this mystery of submitting to the providence of God, yet also using lawful means to get out from under. He starts to deal with this mystery of I can take action, lawful action, even while I'm content with what God's done with me. It's difficult.
I feel right now I should say this podcast has been brought to you by the good folks at the SRPC Audio Archives, and we're sure appreciative of their message. Yeah. No, you're right. There's a huge degree of consistency between the two. Yeah.
Dave, isn't this really what Moses was exhorting us to in Deuteronomy 29:29 passage? We have both secret things belong to the Lord, but the things that are revealed belong to me to do them unto our children.
That's right.
So to search the scriptures is to be able to, we have a duty in that, but it doesn't keep us from saying, yes, Lord.
That's right, yeah. That Deuteronomy 29 section is quite appropriate for this. Yeah. Henry begins his next section in 1b. There is a meekness toward our brethren, toward all men. And we see here in Titus, Paul saying, remind them to be subject to rulers and authorities, to obey, to be ready for every good work, to speak evil of no one, to be peaceable, gentle, showing all humility, that is meekness, to all men. Well, this chapter of Titus begins with an exhortation to be submissive to be subject to rulers and authorities. In what posture? To be ready to obey, ready for good works, ready to speak evil of no one, and I assume he means especially those rulers and those who are in authority over you, ready to be peaceable, gentle, showing all humility and meekness. Meekness is important not only for the disposition of our own soul, but it's also important that our neighbors see it in us. There is a benefit for your neighbors seeing meekness in you. Meekness, as Henry writes, is especially conversant about the affection of anger, not wholly to extirpate it and eradicate it out of the soul, but its office is to direct and govern this affection, that we may be angry and sin not. So there is another element to meekness of not only submitting, but it has sort of a precise view of looking at how anger permeates all of life on the inside and on the outside. And Henry is saying meekness is really important for a life to be led without anger. Ephesians 4:26 tells us to be angry and do not sin. Do not let the sun go down on your wrath, nor give place to the devil. Which is citation from Psalm 4:4. Be angry and do not sin. Meditate within your heart and on your bed, and be still. Selah. In fact, I had never really quite seen the position of that Selah before, as I had when I was looking at these verses in Psalm 4. Be angry and do not sin. Meditate within your heart on your bed and be still. The wrath of man is generally not a good thing. It certainly has beneficial elements. The passage says, be angry and do not sin, right? I mean, not all anger is wrong. But the wrath of man generally is more unproductive than productive. There are more instances of it not being helpful than being helpful. And Henry isn't saying, don't ever be angry. Right? That's not the point. That's not what he's saying. In fact, failing to be angry about wickedness is a sin. It's a vice, not a virtue. You're required to be righteously indignant. But that's not the thing that most of us struggle with. When people struggle with anger, it's generally being angry at the wrong things. In Numbers chapter 12, we read that God describes Moses as the meekest man on the planet. And when was that description given? In verses 1 through 9, I want to read the first part of that. Miriam and Aaron spoke against Moses because of the Ethiopian woman whom he had married. Here you are in the middle of nowhere. Have you got nothing better to do than argue about who Moses takes as a wife? For he had married an Ethiopian woman. So they said, "Has the Lord indeed spoken only through Moses?" How'd we get from "he took a wife" to now we're over here questioning his authority? "Has he not spoken through us also?" "And the Lord heard it." You got to love some of these. The Lord heard what, of course he heard what said, but the Lord heard. "Now, the man Moses was very humble, more than being meek, more than all the men who were on the face of the earth. Suddenly the Lord said to Moses, 'Aaron and Miriam, come out you three to the tabernacle of meeting.' So the three came out. Then the Lord came down in the pillar of the cloud and stood at the door of the tabernacle and called to Aaron and Miriam. And they both went forward. So the anger of the Lord was aroused against them, and he departed. And when the cloud departed from above the tabernacle, suddenly Miriam became leprous, as white as snow." So here we have Henry instructing us that the anger of man is not generally a good thing, and meekness and anger don't go together, and you need to show meekness toward your brethren because it shows how you're controlling anger, that you're not being aroused in an angry fashion, in an unjust way. And he uses this one example, Numbers 12, which is what? God getting angry because of what happened. And at the same time, calling Moses the meekest man on the face of the earth. So here were these accusations coming against Moses, and he appears to be reasonably unfazed by it all. Maybe he was laughing on the inside. What's the Ethiopian woman got to do with whether the Lord spoke to me? I don't know. But God was quite upset about it because of this rebellion. And you look at this reminder that we have in Titus, teaching others to be gentle, to be meek. It's quite an injunction. So Henry says, anger is a real problem and meekness helps you solve it. And he offers, by contrast, the Greeks and the Latins. That's how they would like to refer to these folks. Meekness in the school of the philosophers is a virtue consisting in a mean between the extremes of rash, excessive anger on the one hand and a defect of anger on the other, in which Aristotle confesses it very hard exactly to determine. He's right. I went back and read in Aristotle's Ethics what he was referring to, and it is very hard to determine, if you're a student of Aristotle, what he means by this. Just how are you supposed to know what sort of anger that you need? And the best it appears to me that Aristotle could settle upon is the halfway mark between irascibility and inirascibility. Now, I hope that's helpful to some, but it didn't seem particularly helpful to me that I need to see the happy medium between irascibility and inirascibility. So, it looked like to me that the Greeks were in this pursuit of trying to find these happy mediums between these extremes that they all thought were dangerous. The Stoics had a different take on things. Seneca, in his letter to Novatus, writes, "Certain wise men, therefore, have claimed that anger is temporary madness." And he has much more to say in De Ira, his work on anger. But the appeal to be collected And to be composed is based in part because that is the natural state of man. So that's what we should aim for, is to be part of the natural state of man. And from what I can tell, vengeance is perfectly appropriate, but being angry about it isn't. So the Stoics also had some ideas about anger, and of course, you know, this is what the world is going to think about when it considers how are we to govern our anger. When's it right to be angry? When's it not right to be angry? Henry has one working definition here, and he's building upon that, and how meekness helps us to control our anger. And he's saying the rest of the world has got very defective ways of thinking about this, and you don't want to follow these guys. This is nonsense. To follow the Greeks or to follow the Stoics is not going to produce what God wants to work in your life. In fact, his next point is meekness is a fruit of the Spirit. Galatians 5, 22 and 23. Love, joy, peace, long-suffering, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, that is meekness, self-controlled, and against such there is no law. So, meekness takes a different route than the philosophy of men. Meekness does not search for the happy medium of maybe submission and rebellion, of maybe quietness and agitation, sort of figuring out what each one requires and aiming for the happy medium between the two. That's not what meekness is. Meekness is a fruit of the Spirit that produces many things in us. And Dietrich von Hildebrand, I think, had an excellent summary. He says, "Nor again should meekness be confused with the aloof composure or the ataraxy of the Stoic, the cool self-control of the latter, who refuses to be affected by an insult, is colored by indifference and neutrality, a mood far removed from the warm breath of charity exhaled by Christian meekness." That's a good sentence. What underlies this meekness of the Stoic is not loving kindness nor a value response in reference to a fellow person, but a habit of apathy and self-discipline acquired by sedulous training and cultivated as an end in itself. Meekness is a fruit of the Spirit, something cultivated by the work of God. It knows that when God does things, we should be quiet and be still. It knows that when someone violates the law of God, it should have a righteous anger about it, and yet not sin. It knows how to properly complain and what light that complaint should take. And it knows how to hold its own on the inside and on the outside. Now, a good section of the rest of this part of the book is dedicated to how we control and think about anger. And that was about half of the lesson, and we're just a few minutes away from the end, so I don't think we're going to get to that today. So it might be best to just stop rather than trying to break in a new section that we won't be able to complete. But before we do that, I did have one other thing I wanted to ask. What other unbiblical forms of anger have you encountered that you think are often sold to us today as perfectly legitimate? What do you encounter?
Get it out. Let it go. Just give vent to it.
Give vent to your anger. Ah, that's really good. Yeah. Let it out. You'll feel better about it all. Others may not, but you will. Yeah.
Speaking evil of authorities.
Speaking evil of authorities. Oh, sure. Sure.
I assume
grumbling.
Grumbling? Yeah.
Okay. Good.
Keep it all in, just let it simmer. Don't let it out. Don't affect anyone else. Just hold it all in and just let it simmer inside of you.
Keep all the anger on the inside. So let it all out would be the morning seminar, and in the afternoon we'll teach you how to keep it all in.
Let it out.
after you let it out, you'll need to keep it in. So that would be more the Aristotelian form of trying to figure out what to do. A happy medium. Store it to maybe use as a weapon later or something.
Well,
yeah.
But people have no idea how to get rid of it if it's in. You know, the only way to get it out is to express it.
Right.
It seems acceptable to save your rants for Facebook. it's a little bit like throwing a super tantrum on Facebook. Yeah, that's acceptable.
I wonder if it's also somewhat akin to screaming into the void.
Seems like you need to get into the void first before you do it.
Escape the void. Mm-hmm. That's what I say.
When you get there, Dave is likely to respond with the angry emoji. Any other friendship
requests? All right. You're getting me upset. This, we need some control around here. We got derailed. I got your names down. You're not answering questions next time. Do you think this idea of prizing, this is sort of an introduction for the next class, but prizing composure and quietness would be a real benefit during those times of providence that are dark and intricate? Would you rather go through those acts of providence with a composed and quiet demeanor?
Like what Aaron did.
Like what Aaron did. Sure. Yeah. We don't know what the future holds. So I think it pays to be well equipped. And I think there's almost a little danger in thinking about meekness being anti-anger. And I think it should be rather peace-loving instead. That it so highly prizes peace that it refuses to be angry about these things. So that's your teaser for our next class. We'll pick up and we'll try to finish the rest of chapter 1 next time. Stop it.